All right, so like last week, so I'm gonna do a little bit different for Sunday mornings. I'm gonna do kind of more teacher mode. So always feel free to ask questions, and we'll make comments at the end. But so last week, kind of what I was hoping to do last week is use Paul's life, just because that's what has been helpful for me, but to use Paul's life as kind of something that's provoking. And that's okay.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Okay, thanks. I might use it a little bit. Thanks.
No, that's not a drug.
Okay, no, that's good. Thank you. Appreciate it. No, I'll find a different way to do it. Thanks. I only needed it towards the end. But specifically, we read like 2 Timothy. Who wants to just do that real quick, and we'll just kind of review that passage? 2 Timothy 4, starting in verse 6. Go for it. Good thing this isn't VBS name.
I know.
2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8.
Yeah, no.
This would
be a good game for telephone.
Okay, it's the right one.
Okay,
there we go.
Wrong passage. Sorry. Get sent down.
What do I say?
6 through 8.
For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing.
And so, just highlighting that, you know, like, on one hand, like, why would the early church fathers look at a private letter between this guy and Timothy and go, we have to, like, put that, we're going to take this bundle of new writings and we're going to staple them, or whatever they had, you know. We're going to connect them to the Tanakh. Yeah, sew them to the Tanakh so that people read them as one unit, right? So they're in the process of doing that, and a consensus arises. Let's take this personal letter, the last personal letter of Paul, and let's make sure everybody reads that. This is one of the reasons I think it is that the purpose of this letter seems to be to kind of, like, we're so accustomed to, it doesn't matter whether it's a church pulpit or the talk show or the whatever it is, or your favorite sport or whatever, we're so accustomed to being placated, to being, you know what I mean? To just being soothed. Constantly, that the goal of everything is that everybody should walk out feeling wonderful about themselves, no matter anything. And it's not that he's wanting Timothy, or as a result, anybody's wanting us to walk out feeling like, I hate myself. But he's wanting Timothy to walk away from the letter feeling like concern, alarm. And obviously reading the passage, it's hard not to get that. But the language is triumphant. It's, I did it. I finished that race. I was able to do what I intended to do, which was pour my life out as a drink offering to God. And then going back to Acts 20, we saw that, like, in the trajectory of his life, whether it's starting in Acts 9 where he has that calling from God and he falls off the horse and he's blinded for a while, and he says to Ananias, you have to go, because I have to show him how much he must suffer for my name. You guys remember what happens right after that? He's so excited after his eyes get healed, and he knows that Jesus is the Messiah. He goes into Damascus and he's super excited, and he ends up running for his life. I must show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. And then back in Acts 20, he says, I don't know when you guys are going to see me again, or I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I do know you probably won't see me again because I'm going to Jerusalem. And I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen, but the Spirit keeps testifying that chains and afflictions await me. And he's like, most likely there, which is true. That's what happened. But he says after that, and he goes, but I don't, this is the key, I don't count my life by any means as dear to myself so that I might finish my course. That's what it cost him. To be able to finish the course, not of being Paul the super apostle who got to write scripture. In Paul's mind, Paul, none of that's in Paul's mind. Right? Paul doesn't think any of those things. Those are much later developments. In Paul's mind, Paul's course is being a faithful disciple of Jesus, not being a super disciple of Jesus. And we'll talk about today, flesh it out a little bit. It has different modes. Being a faithful disciple and having a calling from God has different modes, but there's one calling. It has different ways it's going to look in different seasons, different cultures, but there's one calling. Okay. So today, I want to highlight the race language. I'm gonna use that just because it's convenient. Not that he was trying to overly associate what he was doing with a race, but he used the analogy because it was convenient. So I'm gonna use it quite a bit today. So for him, finishing the race didn't so much entail. Sometimes we think of like being a disciple or discipleship, we think of it in terms of attaining character. And Paul didn't see it like that. And I don't think the Bible sees it like that. Being a disciple isn't something that you attain. It's much more fluid and dynamic. Right? Like we read from Ezekiel 18 last week. Like the righteous man goes his whole life. He's great. But if he turns from his righteousness at the end, I won't remember his righteousness. Or the wicked man can be wicked his whole life. And at the end, he turns from his wickedness, I won't remember his wickedness. So it's not so much attaining something, but it's more of a dynamic. And that's why I think a lot of the race analogy is helpful. You know, so like if you were planning a marathon, like we talked about last week, the foolishness of going, yeah, I'm going to run a marathon tomorrow. I've never run before in my life, but I got this. So what a skilled runner does is they understand what's the reason why Mary's not a fair one right now. So Tim, what's the reason why you're most likely not going to physically run a marathon tomorrow and finish it?
Because I don't run ever.
Okay, because he doesn't run. And so, but how does that affect you? How does that affect your the likelihood of you finishing a marathon?
Not being able to finish.
Yeah, it's your strength. You don't have strength. Yeah, you don't have endurance. And so those things, so basically somebody considering finishing the race must consider their own strength and their own endurance. And it's limited. And it's not just this gift from God that you put on. It is a dynamic that you walk through with God. So basically, I'll refer to several times. You guys have heard me say this before, but this is the best. I think this is just the best way of explaining. In kind of modern Western culture, especially, my kids are really excited about the NFL playoffs. Is the analogy of the mindset of leaving it on the field. That is crucial. The mindset that you're going to leave it on the field. changes the way you approach the race. Yeah.
When you say leave it on the field.
Yeah.
You mean
everything.
Just don't hold anything back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like plan. Like I coach soccer, and I coach soccer, and I tell them, guys, you know, your bodies will recover, but fully plan to have to crawl off this field if that's what it takes. Don't have regrets later. Like, fully, like, when you're kind of calculating how much strength you have or energy, like, should I get back? Should I kind of stay here and hover for a while? Fully plan that you're going to crawl off the field because you'll recover. It'll be fine. That's leaving it on the field. Make sense?
Yeah. Actually, it reminds me of a story, if I could share just briefly, of his brother who was in the Navy SEALs.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was in his training, I was, like, trying to get him to tell me stuff that he wouldn't tell me. But he would tell me some of his training stuff. So he was sharing the story of when he... Was it open water? Was he in open water? Or was it like a tank?
Swimming pool.
So he was in a swimming pool, and he was doing scuba diving training, and mm-hmm. his instructors were down with him and whatnot. And then, like, in a brief moment, they, like, all, like, stopped and turned and just came and started beating him up, like, underwater.
Oh, my God.
Like, and they yank your mask off.
They're yanking your mask off. They're, like, trying to kill you.
Wow.
So, and you didn't even know it was going to happen, but obviously, like, you never know what's going to happen in that training. So then he's just trying, and then they stop after a certain amount of time, and then they leave him alone. And so then he's got to know how to, like, reattach his mask, recalibrate, and then recalibrate
wow.
his body to, like, be able to continue. And they keep doing this over and over and over again.
On the same day.
Yeah, all the same stretch. So he's, like, already depleted, then depleted, and, you know, over and over
wow.
again. And then, but he said that you can only fail once. Failing is, like, not reattaching your mask correctly, not recalibrating, going to the top first, you know, going to the surface. And then if you fail a second time after that, then you're kicked out. So anyway, he said this the first time. I don't know if it was like they had come like the second time or third time, whatever, to beat him up in the water. And he's like, I'm not gonna make it. And so then he goes up to the top, and he goes, I could have gone longer. And he just felt this like I hadn't given actually everything
wow.
that I
oh
could
gosh.
Have given. And that's just that story just pops
wow.
in my head, and he was
fascinating.
And he did it the second time when he passed. But I don't know, it just made me think of like
yeah.
that it's the fear of like actually.
Yeah, it's more.
Dying.
It's more than the actual.
Yeah,
that's a good point. So, I think trying to flesh out what it looks like to actually. And when we say leave it on the field, at the same time, I'm not trying to invent like a new cliche that everybody says to each other in our group. It's just being a disciple, right? I mean, that's what he said. It's like, hey, you know, I want to follow you. Luke 9. Okay, very well. Then do this. You know, I don't have a home, so you're going to have to leave and not have a home with me. I don't know if I want to follow you that bad. It's fine. But I have to bury, you know, my father. No, there's no time for that. And, or like the more common ones, the more kind of universalized ones, you too are going to have to take up your cross and follow me if you want to be my disciple. Anybody who doesn't is not able to walk with me, really. So three areas I'm going to focus on today are so managing our strength looks like practically managing three things. If I had, I'd write these three things down, but we're going to talk about them the whole time, so I don't need to put those up on here. Our appetites, our love, and our time. Those are the three things we're going to talk about. Okay, so I'm going to start with time. Time's the most practical of all of them. And why time? So several years ago, John Piper had a tweet. He said this, one of the great uses of Twitter and Facebook will be to prove at the last day that prayerlessness was not from lack of time.
That's real.
So in other words, when So I'm trying to put together what I, the analogy of the race with what he said. So in other words, like, you don't just fail at the race and then stand before God one day and go, oh, I failed. I didn't finish because I just didn't have the strength. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the ability to kind of build up that strength. Didn't have the time. And he might go, well, that's not what it looks like. It doesn't look like you were short of time. That's what I think he's highlighting. But time, this is you know, difficult. But in raising children, like one of the crucial things, like, there's a lot of smaller lessons that you teach, but one of the crucial things in taking a child from childhood to adulthood, it has to do with time. It's teaching them to think about every moment as being more important than right now. That's the transition to adulthood. When they start to understand that right now is much more important than right now, then they start to behave differently right now, right?
Wait, what? You just said... You said
right now is
more important. You said right now is more important than right now.
No, it is.
Right now...
This moment... is much more significant than right now.
Like, yeah. Okay, you just confused me. Right now, three times, and I'm like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in other words, like for a child, like it might begin by just explaining, like, your morning, thinking of time is like, 'cause time's a commodity. Like you start to get older and you realize it's much more valuable than money. It's like, it's much more limited than money. And teaching like a teenager that's coming up, teaching them, listen, this thing that you have in the morning, like, if you sow that, what you do with that time is what you reap in the afternoon or the evening. Teaching a kid that is like, it's hard. It's hard to transition to that because that's not the way you grow up as a kid. But that, your time in the morning, like, what you do with that time, you'll reap it in the afternoon, in the evening. Teaching them that is like, if you've done that, like, things go a lot smoother. And same way with us, right? Today, our time today is something that we can sow in a field and reap a harvest tomorrow. That's why our time is important. That's why our time is important when we think about whether physically running a race. Generally, if you're going to run a marathon, it used to be longer, but now it's narrowed down. I think it's down to 18 weeks is the standard. 18 weeks, you have to have a really strict diet and schedule if you're going to run a marathon in 18 weeks. All 18 weeks are planned. And so, it's just... constantly, if you have the race in mind, then you're 18 weeks ahead of time and you have in your mind, like, what I do right now matters for that race. What I do right now is really important. So let's look at a couple of verses about how kind of Jesus taught disciples to think of time in terms of thinking of time as like currency. That, like, what you do with time is urgent. It matters how you think about right now. So who wants to do Mark 1:15? Okay, Jill. How about Luke 9:59-60? Luke 9:59-60. Mandy. 1 Corinthians 7:29-31. 1 Corinthians 7. Okay. You're 29 through 31. So notice how the very beginning of the proclamation of the gospel is about time. It's about how urgent time is. So who's got, you have Mark?
And saying, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel.
everything from the very beginning of the proclamation of the gospel is about time. Time is short. And that's true no matter when you live. But time is short. Who has Luke 9?
And he said to another, "Follow me." But he said, "Master, let me go first and bury my father." And Yeshua said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and announce the reign of Elohim."
There's no time. I just have to go do this. There's no time to do that. It, like, if there's not a fixed day, then that seems totally unreasonable. If there's not like this is you know, part of what kind of defines the current generation is we're basically, think of millennials. Millennials, one of the things that defines their experience is they have a hard time. It's not just that they're lazy, it's that they have a hard time. They're the product of postmodern thought, which was like the idea that we're not so sure that there is like this narrative that you have to bind reality to. Like that everything's going towards this day of judgment and there's a day of accountability. We're not so sure that's so true. And so being raised in that environment, it doesn't matter if you received a teaching on it. There was this environment that was intentionally trying to disconnect human experience, specifically in the West, from a standard narrative. Like there's a meaning to life. No, there's not a meaning to life. It's whatever I feel life's meaning is. That's the way they were raised. And so absolute truth is like really hard for them to wrestle with. So the way they feel about life is much more important than the way life actually is. Right? And that's just an issue that is going on right now here in the West. But unless... You can't read Jesus and the apostles and not understand that there is something so absolute that would actually justify the God who would send his only son to die for his enemies to demand such urgent things from people. Like, how do you justify the heart of God doing that? Unless there's something fixed and unmovable and it's unbendable and you can't manipulate it. And you can't get on the last day and just go, it's not going to happen that way. That's the only way you can understand the gospel and the life of Jesus, the life of the apostles and their message. There's something so unfixed and fixed and unbending to human will. And he's like, there's a way out for you. But there's one way out for you. Take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. Now, at one point, Jesus, probably intentionally in John, offends his multitude of followers. In the Gospels, it's the biggest group he has following him. In all four Gospels. And he says something and they're offended. And he looks at the 12, and the 12 are still there. And he goes, "Are you guys leaving too?" He goes, and Peter didn't say, "No, man, we're in it to win it." Peter's like, "Well, shoot, what can we do? Like, you have the words of life. Like, dang it, we're stuck with you. We're stuck with your words." Who's got 1 Corinthians 7? Tim? 29 through 31, how to manage time.
"But this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on, even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep, as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice, as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy, as though they did not possess. And those who use in this world, as not misusing it. For the form of this world is passing away."
So in light of time, in light of the timeline. So you have to run the race differently. You're going to look different than other people. So he had just said just before that, generally, when a man marries a woman, he just lives so that they can have this happy home. And that's what they're supposed to live for. So you don't live that way. You can't give yourself to that. He's not talking about living selfishly. He's talking about the opposite. And he says, generally, in the ancient world, when somebody was given to mourning, they give themselves to mourning. It's like a whole season in life. It's like it's too late. You can't just give this season of mourning and give yourself to mourning for a while. There was also other groups who were just giving themselves to debauchery. Because you can't do that. It's too late. And yeah, you have to buy stuff because you're still got to live. He goes, but don't live if somebody who's just like storing stuff up. It's too late. You can't live, even if you're a partaker of this world, don't live like you're in this world for the benefit it gives. Use what you have to, but that's it. Days are cut short. In other words, like just liking it to the marathon idea, he's saying, guys, what you eat is going to be affected, how you live, what time you wake up, how much energy you have, all these things, all these really practical things will get more practical as we go on, but they must be affected if you actually live for what you say you're living for. And it breaks down to time, comes down to time. Okay, that one was time. Why time? This one is appetites. Why our appetites? Listen to this. There's a guy named William James. William James lived about 150 or so years ago. And he's the father of Western philosophy. That's kind of what he's known as. And 150 years ago, or a little bit less, he's a philosopher and a psychologist. And he's coming up with a philosophy of different things, specifically as they related to Western culture, because Western culture even back then was so different than the rest of the world. So he was American. Listen to a couple things he said. Super striking. This is a philosophy like philosophers. They come up with ideas about everything, right? But this is important. This is a philosophy of attention. A philosophy of attention. Attention is the withdrawing from some things in order to deal effectively with others. And it's a condition which has a real opposite in the confused, dazed, and scatterbrained state, which in French is called, and it's translated here, but it's the word distraction. The opposite of attention is distract. Do you know what distract means? Distract, like track, like it basically means to pull off course. It's to allure off course. And he said, so being distracted is the opposite of attention. He goes on here, millions of items of the outward order are present to my senses, which never enter into my experience. Like there are millions of things going on around this room. Much more like outside, visible in the windows. And they're not affecting my life one little bit. Why? Because they have no interest for me. My experience is only what I agree to give my attention to of those millions of things going on. The only thing that affects the way I live is what I decide to pay attention to. Only those things that I notice shape my mind. And this last part just kind of like, let me explain it. Without selective interest, experience is chaos. That means is without having intention on what you look at and decide to give your attention to, your experience or your life is chaos. Chaos in philosophical language means the absence of meaning. You have no meaning unless there's a reason for you to focus on this and not on that. The decision to focus on this and not that is what gives your life meaning. Does that make sense? Because there's endless possibilities of what you're going to focus on, much more now than 150 years ago. I mean, how much do we have access to distraction now? And he says correctly, he said, only the things that you focus on are going to shape your experience, are going to shape what your life's like. And you're only going to select certain things and not others based on what you decide. You have to decide, I will choose that and not that. And that decision to focus and the actual focusing on it is actually what's going to make your life meaningful. It's going to be about something. Yeah.
In the case of, we're talking about, you know, young people growing up.
Yeah.
What about the lack of deciding? What does that mean?
Well, that's what we're going to get to. Okay. So I think the lack of deciding is actually kind of what defines young people.
Okay.
Yeah.
It is deciding, but it's...
It is deciding.
It's being decided.
I think it's the chaos. I think that's what he brings up. It's complete meaningless to life. It's like every influence matters as much as it gets my... endorphins or my dopamine, you know, as soon as it gets my attention like that, it matters because I have no narrative of what's important. There's not, and that's what the last one is. That's what love means. That's love basically means your aim in life. And so when you don't have that, like anything gets my attention, and then your life is chaos. Your life has no meaning. So I think a way to simplify what he said is that either you live for something or you will live for everything and your life will have no meaning.
Reminds me of that age-old saying that my mother used to it's in a different way, but it says if you don't stand for something, you fall for anything.
Yes.
It's exactly
the totally same. The same, yeah.
You have an unfiltered.
Mm-hmm.
But that's... Your unfiltered becomes, your life becomes meaningless.
99.9% of the Western world, especially, their existence is chaos. There's no meaning at all. And even when there's little blips of meaning, it's like this, and then it's descent into chaos, descent into meaninglessness. And so what the reason I started with last week is to try to anchor a reason to say no to some things. Like, really, it doesn't work to not give a binding reason and to just tell people, oh, you know, you shouldn't do that. Don't look at that. Don't watch that. Don't be like this and don't say those things. There's not a reason to do any of those things. It's like if I'm going to run a marathon, then there's a reason. I don't enjoy running. But then there's a reason for me to train. But you just don't go, hey, listen, you can't eat that today. Because in 16 weeks, you know, you got this. If I haven't bought into the race, if I haven't bought into finishing that marathon, then screw that.
Yeah, then waking up at 5 a.m. and running 2 miles, then 5 miles, then 10 miles.
And then not eating good things in between that. Like, no, that's not going to happen.
Being obsessed with it, or even limiting who you spend time with. And how
yes,
you spend time
yeah.
With that.
Like all of those things. That is a life defined by chaos or meaninglessness. And so, like we're talking about in the modern world, this is the main battleground. We'll go into learning to have meaning and anchor your life to meaning. To like this binding heavenly vision like we talked about in Paul. But if you don't have this ability to manage your appetites, the small ones, then your dream is just like your aim to pour your life out is just like a neat thing that you heard one day. And it's never your life is still going to be chaos and it's still going to be meaningless. My dad taught me when I was young that his way of approaching life is, he said, don't, you guys have met my dad. My dad's been here. And my dad told me when I was an older teenager, he said, yeah, he actually illustrated it one time accidentally. I was going to do construction with my dad one time. And we were going to go do construction. We packed a lunch and he was packing his lunch. And my dad had a crazy sweet tooth. Loved sweets his whole life. I'm sure he still does. And we're getting ready to leave. And I see him like he did. You know, he packed up a sandwich and some chips. And he grabbed a bunch of Oreos and put them in a bag because he loved Oreos. And then I saw him pause. And he doesn't know I'm watching, right? I'm down the hall. He's in the kitchen. He paused. And he had a lot of Oreos in the bag. And he took all but like one or two out. And he put them back up. And I was like, why'd you do that? Later I told him, I go, why'd you do that? Like if you didn't want them, like, could have just not eaten them, right? And he goes, no, I wanted them. I said, then why didn't you take them? He goes, that's not how I live. I said, I decided a long time ago, it doesn't matter if it's sinful or not, my flesh never gets everything it wants, ever. I don't know. Okay. He said, yeah, you have to live in training all the time, not just the big times. Like, you basically have to live what my flesh wants, all of the appetites and cravings, like 1 Corinthians 7. The one who makes use of the world as though he didn't make full use of it. Like, it's funny, like, trying to navigate moving back to the States and feeling like an outsider. I think it's funny that, I find it funny as an outsider, that people feel the need, Westerners feel the need to take advantage of every opportunity that they have. Like it's a need, like they must, because it could be withdrawn. And your biggest regret is that you didn't enjoy everything to the full. It's like, no, it's not going to be your biggest regret. Like, and so consequently, opportunities come up and people don't know how to say no to them because it's an opportunity. Yeah, and it ultimately becomes one of these distractions. One of the main, there's nothing binding me to it, so I. And this is a strangely paralyzing thing when you have access, which we have access in the West, to distracting things. It's very difficult to rationalize saying no to those things, unless there's a binding vision at the end of the day. Okay, and lastly, why? So we went time, appetites, and why do I say that to steward your strength, you're going to have to learn to manage your love? So when I say love, I mean it. In a way that we'll highlight in a couple of passages here in a minute. But it's the thing that binds you to a vision. Right? Like, you know, I won't have you read them. I'll just go over them quickly so we can spend a little more time on something else here. Like, first, like we just read 2 Timothy 4. My life is poured out. Right, I did it, I accomplished it, and now there's waiting for me a crown of righteousness, and not only for me, but all those who love his appearing. Right? So the way he kind of summarizes the aim that kept him pouring his life out till the end, or managing his strength to be able to do that, is that he loved Jesus appearing. He lived for that, lived for the coming age and not for this age. And chapter before that in Timothy also mentions another group, which is super, you know, this is obviously, this is not hard to interpret. But it's, he says, Timothy, but be aware of this, 2 Timothy 3:1, but be aware of this, in the last days, these people will come and they won't hear the truth anymore. And instead, they're going to be lovers of themselves. And lovers of money. They'll hate the truth. They'll start raising up for themselves teachers who will tickle their ears, hear what they want to say. Because why do they want to hear that? Because what they love is themselves. Like it's a, like you could say that about all humans always, right? Like lovers of themselves, that's our problem. Is that we love ourselves at the expense of other people. But almost sounds like he's talking about a group of people that'll actually say it. I'm just loving myself. We have arrived. It's like the expressed vision. I just gotta love myself. And but so in talking about it, I'm not gonna spend a whole lot of time on this one because we spent so much time last week talking about it. Having this heavenly vision as your aim is consuming. Doesn't, like the Shema. That's the heavenly vision of being a disciple. There's no, the all doesn't leave room for everything else. You must love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your strength and all of your soul, or all of your life. The word soul means life. Like there's no, it's all. Like the stewardship of your love is all of it being put in one basket, and you have to have that as the one thing. And that's just so odd. That is just so odd and rare. It's becoming much more odd and rare because there's so many flashing lights around now that it is less and less reasonable to keep binding yourself to someone that causes... And that's because that's the thing. It's not that the end game, we want so badly to have a different end game. Usually, at least for somebody who's a sincere disciple of Jesus who really wants to follow him, the end game isn't, I just want to love myself. That's not the problem. The problem with the end game, and the reason like people don't even like wrestling with saying, no, you have to live to love his appearing. You have to live to lay down your life in this age to take it up in the next. The reason people don't like hearing that is because the flashing lights, it's the appetites that we can't deal with. There's so much. We don't like to say no to the little stuff. It's like a constant exercise. It's like, it's not like the guy quits the marathon because he just goes, no, I just decided I'm not into marathons. No, he didn't. He quit because he didn't like waking up at 5 and running. He didn't like saying no to the food he liked to eat. That's why he quit the marathon. That's our real trouble. This thing has so much appeal. But getting that thing fixed, step one, getting your love fixed. What are you living for? There's a story of a guy who I think probably best illustrates all of these things that I'm talking about, of any story that I've ever heard outside of the scriptures. You guys might know of some, and I might be wrong, but this is the one that provokes me because it's so encapsulated. You ever heard of William Borden? William Borden was this young man, grew up in Chicago.
You still said it with
the listening. Dang it! Chicago. Okay. Really wealthy family in Chicago.
No.
That was terrible. Okay, I won't. And really wealthy family. And graduates. So I'm going to give you a timeline of William Borden's life. William Borden was a failed missionary. So, 1904, William Borden graduates from high school, Chicago. His parents, very wealthy, give him as a gift. Think of the time. As a gift, they give him a tour of the world. So he goes on a tour of the entire world. He comes back after a year, and during his stay in China, he noticed this small group in China of Muslims. And there was no witness of the gospel. They were a Christian family. No witness of the gospel there. And he gets back and he says, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to give my whole life to go share the gospel with that small people group. And everybody's like, what? And he was the heir to the fortune. Not lots of siblings. He was the heir to the fortune. All the businesses, everything. and he, fortunately, he journaled extensively, and he left a Bible that he had written a few notes with in the back, of the very back of his Bible. You know how you have the white pages in back for notes? Mm-hmm. He wrote three things down there. Three. And he kind of... I'm not clear if he tethered him with a date on when he wrote it, but in his journal, biographers have matched up what was going on in his journal to when he wrote these things. So he decides he's going to go to Yale, which at the time is a Christian university, going to go to Yale to get trained, and then he's going to go to Princeton. Wealthy dude, right? Going to go to Yale to get trained, then he's going to go to seminary at Princeton to get trained as a missionary. So he goes to Yale and he tells his buddies, and he basically becomes the slander of his group there, that he's going to, this is what he says in his thing, in his journal, that he's throwing his life away as a missionary, throwing all his potential away as a missionary. And at some point around here, during this season, he puts a tag in the back of in the little notes section, and all he says is two words: no reserves. That's it. No reserves. Goes on, he goes to Yale, 1905, goes to Yale. And later on, they interviewed somebody at Yale, and this is what they said about him. He came to college far ahead spiritually than any of us. He had already given his heart in full surrender to Christ and had really done it. We who were his classmates learned to lean on him and find in him a strength that was solid as a rock, just because of this settled purpose and consecration to what he had decided to do. During this time, he wrote in his journal, this is a quote from his journal, "Say no to self and yes to Jesus every time." He also wrote that his purpose in his journal, he said, "I have purpose not to waste my time in the pursuit of amusement." He put in his journal during this time, "I will not waste my time in pursuit of amusement." 1905, he graduates from, 1909, graduates from Yale. And immediately gets offered many lucrative job offers because of his family, because he just graduated from Yale. Said no to all of them, of course. And during this time, right after his graduation, he writes two words in the back of his Bible: no retreat. So initially, no reserves. Gets all these offers to go back. Says no retreat. 1912, he graduates from Princeton Seminary and he leaves for Egypt on a boat. He decided he was going to go to Egypt to learn Arabic to then be able to go to the Muslims who had this small village in China. And he stops over in Egypt and he contracts spinal meningitis and he dies within 1 month of being there. Failed missionary. During that month, he's sick in bed. He has one more entry in the back of his Bible. So they told him he was wasting everything. Remember, during that season, he said, no reserves. He's tempted to go back. Lots of job offers. No retreat. He's about to die. Didn't lead one Muslim to the Lord. All he did was completely waste his life to give his life for the gospel. And he writes during that season, right before his death, so he's sick in bed, spinal meningitis. No regrets. That's all he said. So, but obviously, everybody's life, especially during every season of life, is not going to look like this. But what I hope that we get left with is that there are not many callings. There's one calling. It just has different modes. It just has different seasons. Paul's great fivefold ministry, it's not five different callings. It's one calling to give everything for his name's sake, and it has different modes. Somebody's never heard and been warned about the wrath to come and heard the message of the mercy of the cross, what mode are you going to function in? An evangelist mode, right? If somebody's accepted it and they're struggling to understand some of the ins and outs of what the scripture says, you need a teacher mode. If somebody's heard it and said yes, and now they're wrestling with how to actually live accordingly, you need pastor mode. Right? All those things, it's just one calling. Likewise, William Borden might be what your life looks like. You are giving everything to go as a single dude who's forsaken your entire fortune to go and die as a failed missionary. That might be the mode it looks like. It might look like a single mom raising a disabled child. And you basically have no life, no free time. You're not investing like William Borden at all. The calling, though, is the same. The aim, the marathon, the finish line is the same. It's to pour your life out for his namesake and for the gospels. It's exactly the same. It's just different modes. And the reality is a full-time traveling apostle, a full-time itinerant minister right now, has the exact same pitfall as the mom who's mostly at home taking care of kids. It's to live in a carnal mode of the calling. It's to basically learn to manage it and arrange it in such a way so you can do the basics without actually pouring your life out. You can do it. There's so many sophisticated mechanisms. Doesn't matter if you're a full-time minister or you're a mom, you can figure out how to make life not about emptying yourself out for the gospel. Not hard. It's the option to coast. We have too many, you know, we have few examples like Paul around, and we have a lot of other examples, and it's this, it's almost like a working for the weekend mode. And you get that way in the ministry, you get that way as a mom, you just get that way. I'm just working without any aim except for idleness. And then, what's crazy is the effect of that starts to settle in. And you start to have all sorts of crazy things go on, and you feel terrible, and somehow you get convinced is that you're not living for yourself enough. when in fact, all this saying yes to all these things is causing you to live in chaos. You've descended into absolute meaninglessness. That's why your life feels like that. The solution isn't more chaos. I don't need more time to say yes to everything that distracts me. I know it's enticing, but that's not the truth. That's not what we need. We need meaning. We need to wake up in the morning and know what we're living for, and then still remember it by the time we go to bed. Something in the back of your mind knows your body wasn't meant to die. And so there's this thing that's gripping you constantly. Get in your 30s and your 40s, and the aches start to settle in. You're like, man, something is not right. Like, I'm over the hill. Like, it's breaking down. And some of you, something in you in the back of your mind connects the dots. I don't have an infinite amount of time to be about something. That's why the midlife crisis happens. Midlife crisis is because you go, and midlife crisis is a real deal. It's not about 20-year-olds in sports cars. It's about, what have I done with my life? Because you weren't meant to live in meaningless chaos, saying yes to everything. And part of you knows that. And you fear that you're wasting your life. And if you're stuck in this carnal mode of thinking without that aim of the marathon, then what do? How do you interpret that psychological thing that comes up? You go, shoot, I'm not going to be fulfilled. I better just live for now. Like, let's eat and drink and be merry because we're going to die soon. But on the other end, it can be a blessing. It can be this kind of renewed alarm that the zeal you had to go after that marathon when you were 20, it's worn out. You have long since compromised the zeal you promised to walk in. And you go, oh my gosh. In my mind, I still had that as the end. But I like just spun out. I'm like living for everything in this chaos. My life has no meaning. If anybody off the streets looked at how I spent all of my hours, they would say, this guy lives for nothing just like me. Like, how'd that happen? Praise the Lord for those wake-up calls. Even if they're painful. The reason I think we need these wake-up calls is because pouring your life out, that's not passive. That's the opposite of coasting. Right? You have to be so intentional to say no to distractions, to manage your appetites. It's not bad that you like this or that. You just got to manage it. Like you look at it and you evaluate it and goes, okay, the potential this has to derail me from that, according to the potential that it has, to that degree, I kick it out of my life forever. If I go, well, you know, like, I really enjoy doing this, but, you know, it'll distract me for a couple of hours. But after those couple of hours, generally, like, I snap back. And, like, I can reconnect with the heavenly vision. Fine. Then just, like, don't give yourself to it. Find a way to confine it in time. That's what scheduling's for. You don't go, I don't ever need anything except for preaching the gospel and prayer. You go, no, the things that, like, kind of, like, oh, but I enjoy watching soccer with my kids. Okay, just don't make your life about watching soccer with your kids. Just confine it. So it doesn't take over everything. Or if you go, yeah, I really like doing this, but last time I did that, kind of didn't follow Jesus for 3 years. Then don't ever do that again. Right? You just manage it. Just manage your appetites. They all have this potential to derail you.
Wait, so you're saying that we actually have to be able to have a pretty sincere connection with what actually drives us and what actually does honest. So we actually have to stop doing the things to actually go,
you have to evaluate.
I'm doing this, self-evaluation, not like the, you know, super introspection where it's like digging deep, blah, blah, but just the awareness of, oh, when I listen to that music, 5 minutes after that, I don't want to pray. I don't actually want to love the Lord at all.
Yeah.
And I actually want to go to a concert and do something goofy.
Yep, you that's know, good.
Yeah, just that mirror.
Instantaneous, like, hey, connection. Oh, wow.
The music's a good example. So, like, our family, we're musicians. We love music. And so my kids have been getting into all different sorts of music. And we have this, basically have this rule. So you don't have any idea what music does to you. You have to learn how to, like, I've had to learn, I had to put parameters on music. And at one point in my life, I was like, I can't deal with, like, the effect music has on me. Like, I'm an 80s kid. So, like, all of my view of like, being in a relationship with a woman came from ladies' love ballads. That's not good. That's not good, right? So there was a time when I just had to shut that out. And so, but now I can go back and I can, like, engage with, like, good musicians. My kids are really into the Beatles right now. So I have this rule. So I said, until you can learn to self-manage, I'm going to help you learn to manage. Here's what you do. Listen to it on purpose, never in the background. Can't listen to that stuff and just let it subtly affect. I said, listen on purpose. Get the music. Get the way they structured it. Get the way he's playing that. That's cool. Okay, shut it off. The thing you have running can't be that. The thing you go to sleep to, the thing you have just running while you're doing your homework, cannot be that. You got to learn to manage little practical stuff like that. So here's this little thing. Let me see if I can get this up here. So I tried to put this together to see. Just talk about some practicals. So let's go to the top here. We have it. Oh, let's just move this out of the way since we don't need it. Okay, so first one. So what is the supreme aim or vision? What's the vision? Right? And my couple of suggestions, 2 Timothy 4 being poured out, or having a crown of righteousness, like finishing the race, like Paul. That's a suggestion. But you decide that, first of all. Secondly, to make it practical, how do you aim the whole of your life? Because Jesus is very clear, like, you don't just reach that by approaching it casually, right? I don't know how Christianity's become what it has. But, like, there's just no room for that in the teachings of Jesus. Just give Jesus a try. Like, give Jesus a try. No room for that, at least not in Jesus' teachings. So how do you aim your whole life at this one goal? So, like we talked about, managing your appetites, your time, your love. I think the teachings of Jesus are extremely practical when it comes to how you reach the goal. I think Jesus' teachings are sometimes misunderstood because we fail to place him along with the other rabbis. And the rabbis weren't inventing new instructions or laws for people. The rabbis were generally discussing how we can manage ourselves to make sure that we walk faithfully to God. So a lot of Jesus' teachings are actually Jesus imparting wisdom about knowing yourself and knowing how to manage yourself. Right? It's not like in the Sermon on the Mount, like praying, fasting, giving to the poor, things like that. It's not like you stand before God and he goes, okay, I need a total amount given to the poor. Let me see if you make the cut. Or I need to see exactly how many fast days we had. I mean, I gave you 60 years. That's a lot of days. How many of those did you indulge in food? Right? Doesn't happen that way. But the point of those, the teachings of Jesus are, let me tell you, like my dad taking the Oreos out. Here's how you manage your appetites. You got to weaken them. You got to weaken the things that distract. Like when I was a kid, I don't know if you guys remember this, but when I was a kid, this was really big. I think some big teacher used this analogy, and so it was really big when I was a kid. Everybody used it. I remember it's like a fight of two dogs inside of you. And the one that you feed is the one that's going to win the fight. Right? It's your flesh and your spirit. And a little bit goofy, but what?
The wolves.
Yeah, the wolves. And so if you feed the flesh more, it's going to win out in those fights. And if you feed the spirit more, it's going to win out in those fights. Not quite exactly what Jesus is saying, but it's the idea of managing your appetites, your lusts, your love, managing your time. Because in all practicality, what's prayer? Prayer's time. Like that saying of John Piper, right? The reason, you know, that one of the great uses of Twitter and Facebook on the last day will be to prove that prayerlessness was not due to lack of time. It's due to lack of time management, or lack of vision management, rather, by managing your time. So Jesus is talking about managing these things in a way that keeps our life on the narrow path. Right? Because that's how the Sermon on the Mount ends. All these things are from the Sermon on the Mount. And it ends with, there's a narrow path and there's a broad path. Narrow path leads to life, broad path leads to destruction. It's not easy to stay on the narrow path. And there's very few who find the narrow path. Most are on the broad path. Jesus said it. So I'm trying to give you, that's the summary of the Sermon on the Mount. I'm trying to give you instructions on how to keep yourself, how to manage yourself and stay on the narrow path that leads to life. Fasting included. Prayer included. Guys that I've spent a lot of time with and I've encouraged them in fasting. I had somebody tell me recently that every time. So I strongly encourage, if you've never done it, we can talk about it more. But I strongly encourage regular fasting, weekly fasting. And somebody told me one time that I had encouraged them about this. They said that every time they skip a week, their wife knows it, and they ask them, yeah, you didn't fast this week, did you? It's like, how do you know? You don't want to know. Oh, yes, that's right.
Well, then you need to...
Okay. So how do you aim your whole life at the goal? That's the next thing. Like, basically, it's the beginning of a plan. How do you make a plan? I have prayer, fasting, studying the scriptures, sharing the gospel. Because prayer is essential for strengthening life in the spirit. Fasting weakens the desires of the flesh. So if you have difficulty saying no to all the options, fast. Studying the scripture keeps your mind on that. Right? Studying the scriptures keeps your mind on that. Sharing the gospel. Sharing the gospel is, honestly, why did he say no regrets? Why did William Borden say no regrets? He hadn't shared the gospel with anyone there. Because his point was to pour his life out. And along the path, God was going to bring, he believed God was going to bring many of these Muslims to the Lord. Didn't happen. But he didn't have regrets because really the whole aim was really about pouring his life out. The whole aim to be a missionary was about pouring his life out. So three, how do I plan to execute this consistently? And I just have two suggestions there. Schedule. Like, don't say all of these things are a priority and you'll, I'll just do them when I feel like it. Three, so schedule, and then accountability. Have people around you who are going the same direction, who are deciding also to bind themselves to the heavenly vision, to not live in this meaningless chaos of saying yes to everything. And then encourage one another. Pray for each other. 4, be honest. And this is where Jen said, you got to be honest. What are the obstacles to this goal that will potentially derail you from it, both personally and culturally? Got to be super brutally honest to answer these. Like Luke 14, you don't hate your own life, you're not going to be able to do it. If you don't hate this life, you're not going to be able to do it. If you don't count the cost, you won't be able to do it. Mark 4 says, the desire for other things will cause the seed of the gospel to not bear fruit. Luke 9, looking back. Matthew 13 says, the worries of life. Worries of life will cause you to not walk in the plan to stay on that path long term. 4, literally, like find out what are the real obstacles to me. Like some of them are general and cultural. Some of them are to me. Like when I was younger, I told Carice, I said, I realize it's not sinful, but just for me, I can't have video games in the house. I felt dumb as a grown man, but I was like, video games are going to take me off this path. And I said, so for me, I had to self-manage that way, and I had to go, no video games for me in the house. And to this day, we don't have any in the house. So how do I plan on avoiding these obstacles consistently, identifying them and then making a plan to not do it? And like meet with others to pray, study the scriptures, fasting, managing your time. So it's kind of the same as point 3. How do I do the positive thing? Like how do I execute my plan? And then also the derailers to the plan, you have to identify them and you have to deal with them. Or you become like the man who started to build the tower and you didn't finish because you didn't actually count what it was going to cost. So to bring it back around, just real quick before we pray, to bring it back around, Paul seemed to have this aim, and that's what I'm kind of trying to provoke everybody with, to have his life emptied at the end. I usually have the picture of like Oscar Schindler in my mind. You guys remember that movie where at the end he said, I could have done so much more. I could have saved this guy. I could have sold this and bought this guy. Could have sold this. I could have done that. And it's basically to like have a vision. Like my encouragement in a nutshell is to have a vision to die spent, to die completely poured out, completely broke, completely without energy. Just leave it on the field. You will only regret if you don't do that. I guarantee you, because it's the most clear message in the scriptures, the most clear provable message in the scriptures, is that if you die spent, it's the most unregrettable way of life that you can have. You will only have joy because you did it. You will have no regrets. Have your aim to die spent. Have your aim to leave it on the field.
But just to add to that exact sentiment, that exact understanding of what God actually requires of us, just reminded me of that while ago when I met that mom that had those 12 kids. Because it just reminded me of how people can actually die spent and wasted on
something
else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so just the idea too of being, just really choosing what we spend ourselves on. Because, it kind of reminds me of Mike Bickle's, you know, his teaching about time management and all this. But just even realizing that, you know, him looking back on his life, knowing, like, on Friday in 1985 at 5 p.m., I was doing this.
Yeah.
like you can like you can really curb regret. You can really curb that midlife crisis quite a bit when you really do manage your time. When you really do just die to the need to do whatever you want in the moment and actually commit to those things. And just like people can die wasted on money or on the white picket fence idea or whatever else, but just this reality of committing and dying and wasting our lives for the eternal purpose.
Yeah. You know, William Borden, the guy I was talking about, also in his journal, his first semester, he wrote how disappointed he was in the university's president, because it was a Christian university at the time. And he said he gave his address on having a fixed purpose for your life. And he said, I was so disappointed because everybody in there walked away as though all fixed purposes were of the same value. And he didn't tell them to live for the one that actually matters.